Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I'm Rick, he's Dan, and Dan, this is the 33rd edition of the podcast.
Yes, a long-awaited 33rd edition. We apologize for the lag between recordings.
I was busy getting fired, Dan. I was busy getting fired.
Well, you know how it goes. So, number 33, of course, Brian Grant. Number enshrined in the rafters of Xavier University. Wonderful ceremony for him. Was it last season or the season before? I don't know. They all run together for me now. But wanted to mention as we start off that we are having some Skype issues, so I'm back on the phone, so we apologize for the slightly worse audio quality for this podcast than some of the last ones.
But to make up for it, we do have a great show.
This first guest
basically legitimizes the entire podcast. We've had some pretty big interviews on here, but he's as big as it gets. He's entering his fifth year as the head coach of the Musketeers with an overall record of 90-44 and two Sweet 16 appearances under his belt. It's my pleasure to welcome the head coach of the Xavier Musketeers, Coach Mack. Coach, we appreciate you taking some time out to join us here.
Not a problem. Glad to be with you guys.
All right. Well, Coach, obviously the biggest news in Xavier sports over the summer was the move to the Big East. I want to talk about that more in a minute. But first, I want to talk about the second biggest news story, and that's the arrival of new athletic director Greg Christopher. I know it's only been a few months that you've been working with him, but you've been around him more than any of us have. What are your initial impressions of the new AD of Xavier Athletics?
Well, I think, number one, he's an extremely hard worker. Greg is really taking the time, I think, to evaluate every facet of the athletic department, and not necessarily come in and try to make a ton of changes, you know, right off the bat. I think he's really using this time just to see how things have been done and maybe try to figure out over the course of the year maybe ways that he can improve, every program. Obviously, it's a big step up going to a new conference. But Greg, like I said before, is an extremely hard worker. He's very detail-oriented. He's a guy that really wants to make sure that our facilities are on par with the rest of our conference. Again, a huge step up. And he's been incredibly supportive from day one. And, I think he's going to be a huge asset to our program and to the athletic department as a whole.
Hey, Coach, I remember at your initial press conference when you first got the job as Xavier head coach, you talked about the different roles that you had interacted with Xavier University as. You talked about being a camper back in the day, yeah, a recruit, opposing player, and then obviously an assistant coach. So for you, as you look back on, you know, really over 20 years of connection with Xavier University, how big is the move to the Big East, and what are the tangible differences you think fans, players, recruits are going to see as X moves into the Big East Conference this year?
Well, number one, I think I don't just speak for myself, but I think I speak for the entire, former players, all the former players. It's incredibly humbling. You know, I think a long time ago it was a pipe dream to sort of be in the same conference with the likes of a Georgetown and a Marquette. You know, I remember back when Byron Larkin played and some of the games that were on the schedule. Huntington College, and just a lot different. And obviously what we've tackled in the non-conference part of the schedule over the last 10 years has really upped the ante, has really given Xavier more of a national name. But this conference, I think, elevates the program even further. And if we can, do what we did in the Atlantic 10, which isn't easy, but to be able to compete for Big East championships over the next 5 to 10 years, to put ourselves in Madison Square Garden competing for a conference tournament championship, it says a lot about our program. And again, it's going to be a huge step, but I'm very, very confident in the people that we have at Xavier, the players that we have in our program, and the assistants in terms of their work ethic and their ability to get the job done.
Coach, there's a lot of excitement surrounding everything to do with this move, including Fox Sports 1 and all the money they're putting into being the flagship station of the Big East. As part of the deal with Big East, they're going to be having a Big East tip-off party broadcast on October 25th with a live look in at all 10 programs as they kind of have their own form of Midnight Madness there, despite the fact that it's at 9 p.m. from my point of view, this is the type of thing that sounds like awesome exposure for Xavier basketball and the Big East Conference as a whole. What are your thoughts about an event like this, and are you guys kind of getting excited for something like this to be coming up?
I mean, it's really exciting. You know, it does wonders for recruiting. You know, to be shown in almost 100 million homes, just to practice, just an introduction to your team. Again, Fox Sports 1 is, they're going to do their job. They're really going to promote, you know, all the programs in the Big East. You know, we're the only conference that they're highlighting. Virtually every game that we play in conference is going to be on Fox Sports 1. They're making a push, and they're going to be a major player. And I think the benefits may not be, you know, this January, this February, but down the line, as they continue to sort of hammer away and gain exposure for the member schools, it's going to do wonders for our program. So, again, remember when we had Midnight Madness years ago in Schmidt Fieldhouse? And, you know, although we had a great turnout, the only people that really saw it were the sweaty people in Schmidt Fieldhouse. Now to know that anybody across the country is going to be able to see, you know, our product, our university, our program, it's a great thing and one we're looking really, really forward to.
Hey, Coach, Rick and I wanted to maybe have you walk us through some of the newcomers on the team and two guys that were sort of, unfortunately, for reasons really beyond their control, locked out of being part of the team last year were Miles Davis and Jalen Reynolds. Can you talk a little bit about how those two guys dealt with that year of sort of being part of the program but not part of the program, and how they've, yeah, and your reflections on where they are as they move into what will be their freshman year from a basketball perspective?
Yeah, I would say, number one, it was a very, very difficult year for them. Probably the first year that they can remember in a long, long time since they were kids that they weren't able to play basketball competitively. I'm sure they played in some open gyms at different high schools and whatnot, and, you know, maybe at the O'Connor Sports Center and some intramurals, but it's not the same when you're part of a team. Now, I will correct you a little bit, and when you say factors beyond their control, you know, that's the one thing I think that, you know, kids out there have to understand that, you know, academically, you have to get the job done, be able to play at the Division I level. You know, it's challenging. You know, the responsibility of, you know, making sure you handle your schoolwork is one that I think Miles and Jalen unfortunately learned the hard way. And they did a great job as freshmen, going to every class, doing really well, putting themselves in a position of being eligible, not just being eligible, but achieving. But again, they had to learn the hard way. As far as being a player, I have tremendous confidence in both of them. You know, I know their hunger is going to be at an all-time high. Anytime you go a year without something that you love, you know, you cherish it. You know, you don't take it for granted. You know, what Miles brings to the table, I think, number one, he's very vocal. He knows what's going on the basketball floor. He's got a high IQ for the game. He's certainly a high-level shooter, as I think a lot of people know and have heard about. But he's more than just a shooter. He's not going to sit in the corner and wait for penetration and only be able to shoot the ball. He can take you off the dribble. He can expose, you know, bad closeouts. He knows how to feed the post. I think he's a conscientious defender. I don't think he's a lockdown defender, but he cares. So Miles is a big game type player. I think the bigger the moment, the more Miles will step up to the challenge, and it's hard to find sometimes. As far as Jalen Reynolds goes, I could tell you that I don't know if I've coached a better athlete. You know, he's got a lot to learn between the ears, between now and the start of the season. You know, he's going to be a guy that, you know, fans are going to have a little patience with because, you know, college is a different game. The game moves a lot faster. But I'll tell you, Jalen has some physical abilities and some tools that you can't teach. You know, he can get the ball well above the rim, whether he's rebounding on the offensive end, the defensive end. He's a tremendous finisher. He's got touch with either hand, not just in and around the basket, but, you know, all the way out to the three-point line. His tools are endless. And, you know, we're really looking forward to Jalen making a huge impact on our team this year.
Hey, Coach, we've got to see some of the actual freshmen coming in this guy, the 2013 class this year in the summer league, but that really only scratches the surface when it comes to find out what type of player these guys are going to be. I know you're not exactly practicing yet or anything, but what have you seen from these young guys so far? Brandon Randolph, Kamal Richards, Remy Abel, obviously a transfer who you kind of already, right, knew what he had coming in, but what has stuck out to you about these guys?
Well, you know, I would tell you that, number one, Brandon Randolph is going to make an immediate impact on our program. You know, I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to come to a four-man workout and see that he adjusts very quickly to this level. You know, the speed, the quickness of the game, the physicality needed. Brandon brings all those things to the table, and he's a very, very quick learner. I have all the confidence in the world that he can be a lockdown defender. Maybe not so much early, because he's got to learn all the different screening actions and the things that teams do at this level. But in terms of ability, you know, he'll be up there with some of the better ones we've coached. Offensively, you know, he can shoot it, he can drive it, he's got a quick first step. He'll play both the one and the two. I'm really excited about Brandon's future. You know, Kamal is a little bit behind Brandon. You know, Kamal is a guy that is a physical small forward. He's left-handed. You know, he can shoot the ball out to the three-point line, but the speed of the game, he has to be caught up. And that's not different for a lot of freshmen. You know, that's something all freshmen struggle with. But hopefully here during the preseason, you know, Kamal can sort of carve out a role and be a guy that eventually gets to earn minutes on the floor. He's ultra competitive. He just has to understand that every drill we do, it's meaningful. It's a competitive thing that, you know, we're asking you to bring the fire each and every drill, whether it's a 2-on-2 or 2-on-0, doesn't matter. And so he'll have to learn those things, but I'm confident he will.
Coach, when you look at your big men for the upcoming season, two of the guys that are going to play a critical role are Matt Stainbrook, transfer from Western Michigan, and then Isaiah Fillmore, who seemed to be physically limited last year due to his knee injury, but started to come into his own toward the end of the season. Can you talk about what you expect from those two guys and the sort of progress people can expect to see with them as they get bedded into this system over the course of the year?
Sure. Sure, I would say number one, the first thing we're going to ask of them is leadership. You know, both of them are in their senior year. Obviously, Matt in his true senior year, and Isaiah as a fifth-year senior. But they're both smart basketball players. They both care an awful lot. They're excellent leaders. You know, they're guys that set the right example for how to conduct themselves on and off the floor. And you know, I really expect leadership. It's obviously easy to be a leader when things are going well. But I think, you know, in signs of adversity, those guys are going to do a great job for us, number one. You know, Isaiah looks as good as he's ever had in a Xavier practice jersey. You know, he's light. He's not overweight. He came in really fit to start the fall, which is what we expected as a fifth-year senior. He's been great in the preseason. I'm really looking forward to Isaiah really continuing to play in much the same way he ended the season a year ago. And then obviously a lot's been talked about when it comes to Matt Stainbrook, who will play the five position for us. Matt's the biggest player on our team. You know, he's about 6'10 and a half, 6'11, 265, 270 pounds. I think he'll be a guy that plays with a high IQ, really knows how to seal his man inside, very unselfish, good passer. And so Matt's going to be he's going to be a load for us. We're going to count on him to do an awful lot on both ends of the floor.
Coach, one other guy that we thought might be a part of this class that it turns out is not going to be with that, Alexander Vezenkov, obviously an international recruit. Things changed quickly there. It was a different situation, obviously not your typical recruiting situation that you're used to. Could you just explain what happened there at the end and sort of what went on in the final days of his recruitment?
Yeah, I don't know how long we have on the podcast, but you can imagine the roller coaster of emotions and just the roller coaster of events that sort of happened over the last couple months with Alex. You know, we fully expected Alex to arrive on campus in the fall. And I went over to watch him in the under-19 European Championships, under-18 European Championships. Played extremely well. His team was terrible, but Alex played really well and led the championships in scoring. And because of that, had a multitude of offers. And, you know, when you grow up in Europe, it's a different culture. You know, I think obviously Americans don't necessarily understand you know, when you get out of high school or we get out of club ball, you really had that decision, you know, do you hang up the game or do you turn professional? Obviously if you have the opportunities, you do that. And so really felt like we had a really good shot at Alex, but the offers that he got were just for him and his family too hard to pass up. And Alex was extremely invested in Xavier. I know he felt extremely remorseful, but obviously not enough to come and join us. But, you know, for us, it's just a speed bump in the road. You know, we we lose guys all the time. Obviously, it's a little bit more highly publicized nowadays than it was 10, 15 years ago, but that's okay. We'll continue to look and hunt for guys that want to wear a Xavier uniform and represent us as well as they can.
Coach, you've been great with your time. We really appreciate you coming on. Give us a little preview here of what's coming up for you. I know rules have changed a little bit with the NCAA. When are you guys going to start practice exactly?
Well, you know, this year we're sort of balancing recruiting. You know, you're allowed to go out on the road September 9th, go visit kids, whether they're seniors that you're going to sign, whether it's freshmen that you're just trying to get a beat on that you've heard about. So anywhere in between. And then we actually start practice 6 weeks before our first game. You know, Gardner-Webb is our first game on Friday, November 8th. So you rewind it 6 months, and that puts us at September 27th. We'll actually begin practice September 30th, because of those 42 days, you're only allowed to practice in 30 of them. So you have to sort of pick and choose, give guys more off days. And so that's what we chose to do. So for us, we'll have 30 of the next 39 days once September 30th rolls around to get this season started.
He is the head coach of the Xavier Musketeers. Coach, we really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot.
Fellas, thanks for having me.
We obviously appreciate Coach Mack coming on the podcast, taking some time out of his busy day, his recruiting responsibilities, obviously, and getting prepared for the new season. So we appreciate his time. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to him again before too long. One thing that did come out this week is that the Chris Mack radio show has a new location at the Dilly Deli in Marymount. There's been some debate about that. I can tell you that the food there is really good. And it's really convenient to my house, so I'll get to go more often. But that doesn't really help you, Rick, down in Latonia or wherever, whatever part of Kentucky you live in.
I'm going to be there, Dan. I was told I get a free drink, so I'm going to be there. Well, it's only right that we kind of start off this portion with the big news of the week. On Monday, Chris Mack and his staff landed their priority target on the wing. J.P. McCura out of Minnesota, a 6'5 sharpshooter, ended up being the top guy on their list, actually. I mean, it had come down, they were really recruiting Justin Bibbs for a long time, and he was kind of the priority guy. But when Rick Carter joined the staff earlier this summer and McCura came into the fold, you know, Max, Steele, Pekiz, they all got a chance to see him and kind of decided that was their guy. And it's basically because of his offensive ability. He's a super aggressive scorer, a really good athlete, and he's one of the elite shooters in the 2014 class. And I think Chris Mack added a really nice player in J.P. McCura.
Yeah, and I think it addresses an issue, perhaps the glaring statistical issue with the Musketeers last year, which is that they just didn't make a weapon at all as a three-point shot. Actually shot a decent enough three-point percentage last year. They were 35%, which is better than average in NCAA Division I. But they only attempted 400 three-pointers all season long. That was 341st out of 351 Division I teams. And there was no – when you watched the Muskies play last year, they just had no perimeter threat whatsoever. I mean, D. Davis, Justin Martin are okay three-point shooters. D. Davis, pretty good three-point shooter. But neither one – both seem to sort of drift in and out of having the confidence to take those shots. Samaje Christen hasn't really developed that portion of his game. And Brad Redford, you know, did what he did. But when there's only one real perimeter threat, he couldn't get a whole lot of looks. So there's no secret that the Musketeers need to add shooters. And with Miles Davis in the fold this year and with J.P. McCura coming the following year, certainly they've begun that process.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting when you start thinking about some of the combinations that they can put on the floor in the future. I mean, they already have Edmund Sumner in this 2014 class as kind of like the lead guard. Whether he's going to be playing the one or the two, he's a combo guard that can really handle it. But he's one of the better shooters that I can think coming in that the Musketeers have gotten at the guard position. I mean, he's a legitimate three-point threat already, and I would only assume he'll continue to improve in that regard. So you could legitimately have a Sumner, a Miles Davis, and a J.P. McCura all on the floor at the same time. And let's not forget about Remy Abel, who can also stroke it from three-point land. I mean, he didn't shoot a lot of them at Indiana, but he's, you know, at the very worst, a Dante Jackson type of player in the sense that he's going to be able to knock down and make you respect his ability to shoot a three-pointer and take them when they come to him and when he's open. I just look at going forward, and you saw the results of what not having perimeter threats can do, and that is Last year, they had to work so hard for every point that they got. They had to play a low-scoring style, and even on offense, they'd be in attack mode, but they'd have to take 20 seconds off the clock just to get a good look because they're battling so hard to get inside the paint or get a box touch, as it's called, with one of the guards on a drive that they just it was too much work. It was so hard for this team to score, and Samaje labored so much to carry the offense. I think they've made a conscious effort to improve that, improve their offensive skill set on the roster, and as a whole, they're going to be able to score points a lot easier going forward into 2014 and beyond, I think.
Well, how many times did we see it last year where X would have a really positive passage of play, they'd get a kill on defense or something like that, they would score, you know, two field goals in five possessions or something like that, then the other team comes down and hits a three and it wipes away all that good work. I'm thinking about that Robert Morris game
early in
the season when X came out and really was on top as far as they were. Or Vanderbilt, another good example. They were very aggressive. They were pushing the tempo. They were getting turnovers on defense. They were getting good looks offensively and finishing some of them. But they were all two-point shots. And at the other end, a guy throws in a knuckleball from 25 feet. And then maybe you have a defensive breakdown and there's 6 points on the board. And that neutralizes all the good work you just did over the previous 3 or 4 minutes. So having having ability to score at all three levels, as Snow talks about, is critical for Xavier. This is going to be critical for Xavier moving forward. They've got the drive into the basket with Samaje Christen this year and hopefully with Brandon Randolph in future years. And now by adding a Miles Davis, by adding a J.P. McCura, hopefully you can add that, and Edmund Sumner, obviously, Remy Abel too. You add that three-point threat, and it's going to be critical for this team because the three-point shot, with the diffusion of talent across Division One, with the fact that so many teams, as they do more statistical analysis and they realize as underdogs they can keep games close by slowing them down and limiting possessions, being able to make teams pay at the three-point line is critical.
Well, and real quick before we get off this topic, I did get a question on Twitter today where someone wanted us to break down the differences between Justin Bibbs and J.P. McCura, and why, you know, if McCura was the priority, why that was. And like I said, I think it was because his offensive ability mostly. What happened basically was Justin Bibbs, I think the staff still would have been happy to get. He was a good player, a borderline top 100 type guy. What I saw out of Justin and the difference between him and J.P. was Justin does everything well. He was going to be a good defender. He's a good athlete, not super explosive or great, but he's good enough, plenty good. He can handle it. He can pass it. He can shoot it. He can do all those things. He's just not a super aggressive guy. I think he's fairly smart. I don't think he's necessarily the toughest guy on the wing. I don't think he's like a great rebounder or a super tough defender, even though I think he's pretty good in, like I said, just about every area of the game. The problem is I look at a guy like that, and while he could end up developing and being a very nice starter and role player on your team, I don't ever see him breaking out and becoming more than a guy who maybe averages 8 to 10, 12 at the very most points a game. And don't get me wrong, you may take that, but I think the upside with McCura was that he could change what you do offensively. He's an elite shooter. Not a good shooter, not a guy who's going to knock down open shots, but an elite shooter who's super aggressive, and teams are worried about him. He is a threat. Teams have to adjust their defense to know where he is on the court. And not just that he's a shooter, but he can also attack those closeouts. When, like Chris Mack was talking about with Brad Redford in that interview, with Miles Davis, rather, in that interview, that he can attack a bad closeout. That's what Redford couldn't do. Redford, teams were able to play 5 steps off of him, help against the drive, and then as soon as the ball was kicked, they'd fly out and jump at him to make sure he didn't get a three off. And he wouldn't make them pay by going around him and scoring off the dribble or getting into the lane and creating. And McCura is 6'5". He can jump well. He can finish at the rim. And he has a very smooth mid-range game. So I think that's what kind of won them over it. And like I said, he actually became the priority on the wing once Rick Carter kind of brought him into the fold for Xavier. And originally, he was a Butler lean, I should say. Right after, that coincided with the same time Rick Carter was arriving at Xavier. Brad Stevens then left to the Boston Celtics. McCura's recruitment kind of completely opened back up, and that's when Xavier made him their priority.
And, of course, they secured his commitment over a new conference rival in Creighton, a team that had a really nice team last year that's got a very well-respected coach. And there's a team coming back this year that could be a Big East favorite.
Yeah, and it's only about 300 miles away from his house as opposed to about 750 with Xavier. So, I mean, definitely a lot closer.
And that's absolutely true. And I want to talk more from a bigger picture, how impressive it is that Rick Carter was able to get this recruitment done in such a short period of time. Certainly, we have seen in the past when Xavier assistant coaches have left, a lot of people have bemoaned the fact they've taken recruits with them. And you've seen, you know, when a guy like when an Ashley Howard leaves or a Bino Ransom leaves or whoever, a lot of times we've seen Xavier commits or top priority Xavier prospects fall off the board. Well, here's a good example of you bring in an assistant coach, a talented assistant coach, who's able to immediately hit the ground running and bring in a guy of his own. And I think that's critical. And I think I'm really happy for Coach Carter that he was able to do that, because certainly there have been situations where other incoming Xavier assistant coaches haven't had those built-in relationships, and as a result, it's taken them a while to ramp up. And while that is, you know, natural to a certain extent, this 2014 class is so important to Xavier with the probable departure of Samaje Christen that it was important for him to hit the ground running. So a great job by Coach Carter. When we look at the 2014 class, Rick, you know, Edmund Sumner in the fold, now J.P. McCura. However, Melvin Swift did drop off the board. Sort of some misgivings there about how that was done. What's your understanding of how that relationship sort of, I don't even think it really soured, but where the decision was made to part ways?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, going back to what we've all said all along, I mean, this didn't come as a surprise to anyone, I don't think. We've talked about it on the podcast before, and you know, Ashley Howard left. He was the one who had the relationship with Melvin. Xavier kind of took a quick commitment from the kid after getting in on him and realized they could get a guy who was ranked, you know, with the top 80, I believe, at the time, and land him, and they did so. And I don't think it was a bad idea at the time. You remember they're coming off the Des Wells situation. I think it was a good get at the time, and then Ashley moved on, so they didn't have a coach that knew as much about him. He didn't start recruiting him to Villanova at all, and, you know, Melvin initially stayed committed to Xavier, but he's had a kid since then. He struggled with school. He was blowing off the NBA's top 100 players camp this summer. There are a lot of things going on that Xavier basically just looked at it and said, you need to get some other priorities straight. You need to make sure you do what's best for you. And that's not coming to Xavier right now. I don't know that he's going to have the grades to do that at this point. I don't know enough about his situation, but it was just kind of a mutual thing where they kind of talked to him and said, look, for your future, this is the best situation. Things have obviously changed with you, and you've got a lot going on. You probably need to look a little closer to home and kind of figure out your situation and do what's best for you and your family going forward. So that's really what happened there. Multiple reasons why that didn't work out. But now they open that back up. They have two scholarships basically that they're trying to fill in the 2014 class. And with that specific Melvin Swift spot, they kind of have some flexibility when it comes to replacing him. This player that's coming in at that spot is going to come in with other guys capable of playing the four in front of him. So they're definitely going to replace him with a forward, but they could get, like, I mean, they were going after Justin Tillman, who recently committed to VCU, and he was more of a, we've talked about it before, like a Travis Taylor type, a big-time rebounder, a scorer on the block who's got some explosion and things like that, but more of a true back-to-the-basket power forward. And they're also looking at their other top target right now, who's coming in on official visit this weekend, is McKinday London, who's more of a stretch guy, a combo forward. Keelan Martin is another name that's been thrown around in the past. They offered him in July. It sounds like Butler's kind of in the lead for him, but he's a super skilled, almost a three on offense, but he'd probably have to guard fours on defense. So he's, again, another combo type of guy. And then just this week, they offered 6'6 combo forward Rashard Kelly after Mac visited him at Hargrave. And Kelly's just a bundle of energy, played for the DC Assault AAU program, a great athlete, and another combo guy at just 6'6. He can handle it, and he's kind of more of a catch and take you off the bounce a couple steps, and get to the rim and rebound and get garbage points type of player. Wichita State, Cincinnati, Minnesota, and Marshall are kind of the schools that Xavier's competing with right now for him. But that's kind of the situation with that four spot. The other spot is going to be a center. And the only real center target that seems to be a viable option right now is Sean O'Mara, who was also visiting this weekend. And I I don't know. I'm sure there's another guy or two that they've either been looking at or they're going to check out here while they're allowed out to recruit guys like Coach Mack was alluding to earlier. But Omara is a guy that I think they're kind of the top school that's recruiting him. They have a really good relationship. They've made him a priority for a long time, and he's kind of the guy that they think fits what they need. So I do think they've got a good chance of landing him, but it's recruiting. It's never over. The situation's going to remain fluid. And like I said, that I'm sure there's another guy or two that they've been looking at that we're just not aware of yet.
So you know who also went to Hargraves, of course?
David
F. West.
David F. West, that's correct.
Right. We can't say his middle name on this is a family show.
Right.
So when you look at that power forward spot, because that seems to be the one that's up in the air. It seems like everybody's kind of just waiting for a commitment from Omara, and if it doesn't come, they'll move on and they'll try somebody else, but it seems like they're in a pretty good spot with him. Mackinday London appears to be the top recruit at that four. I believe I saw today that he's scheduled three official visits, Xavier being one of them, and he's also going to look at Miami and a third school Virginia Tech, correct?
Right.
Do you think that there's any, do you get the sense that there's any leader for him at this point, or is he sort of being close to the vest about his recruitment?
You know, I think they're kind of playing it close to the vest. I mean, you know, Xavier and VCU has kind of been rumored as the two favorites for a long time now. VCU is still recruiting him. I mean, he's going to visit there October 11th and 13th, and his AAU coach and his family has been pretty clear that they're still looking at all their options, and I think Xavier is definitely in the mix here, but I just don't think they're far enough along in the process to be sitting around waiting for commitment and expect this thing to be over right now. I mean, you know, like you said, he's going to take Xavier, Miami, and VCU are the three scheduled official visits, and then still on his list, Mississippi State and Florida. So Xavier's got some good competition in this recruitment. It's not going to be an easy one, but if you were to ask me at this point, I don't think I'd trade places with any other school in terms of landing him.
When we discussed the 2014 class during the last podcast, there were a couple more guys on the board that are no longer on the board. Trayvon Blewett going to UCLA. Bibbs obviously committing to Virginia Tech, Tillman to VCU. But at that point, we had talked about the fact that X would, and actually Brandon and McIntosh as well, recently committed. Would X still consider taking five players in this class if somebody else came along that they just couldn't say no to, or are those players pretty much off the board?
No, I mean, I think if there was a player that you never know, there can be late bloomers. I mean, we saw that with Samaje Christen, and he ended up prepping another year after that. So it's not like, you know, he was that late of a blue. He was that late of a commitment or anything as it turned out. But I think when you look at it, they're still going to continue to review all options, but it's exactly what you said. There just aren't going to be those types of players out there that you would take no matter what. If there was one available, sure, they would still do that. But I think they're going, at this point, have a hard time just getting those four guys that they definitely
right.
want. And I don't think they'll take someone who's not good enough. I think they're definitely just going to review the options that make sense for them, fill as many of those spots as possible. And if they have one or two roster spots open, they've been through that before, and it leaves the door open for transfers or things of that nature.
Rick, last topic as we talk about the recruiting situation at this point, does the Melvin Swift situation illustrate any pitfalls to going for that early commitment?
I mean, sure.
Let me flesh that out a little bit more. The conventional wisdom as regards X used to be that because of their status in the Atlantic 10, that their best chance of landing that top quality recruit was to get in way early, get a commitment early, get the kid bought in, and then sort of wait it out. And I think the poster child for that would be Des Wells. When you look at the Swift situation, though, is X to a point where they no longer really need to take that tack to just reserve it for really special players? Or was this just a one-off where it's just a kid that lives a long way away, where the relationship was no longer in place at the school, and there just wasn't really any reason for either side to move forward.
Well, that thinking, what you mentioned there with you've got to get in on the top guys early to land them, that extends well beyond just Xavier being in the Atlantic 10. I mean, going back just a few years ago when Billy Gillespie was at Kentucky, he was offering eighth graders. And in football, they're doing the same thing at some of the biggest SEC schools. I mean, it's become so cutthroat and so competitive in recruiting that now, you know, John Calipari isn't doing that because he doesn't have to. He's going to get the top guys. But outside of him, you're seeing almost every other school, if they think a kid's good enough, going ahead and offering. I mean, I was surprised when Ohio State just took a commitment from A.J. Harris in the 2015 class. But, I mean, it's exactly right. What you're talking about. It's a thin class for point guards. If they think he's good enough, they're going ahead and take the commitment now and make sure they lock him up. That thinking doesn't stop at just Xavier being in the Atlantic 10. So, no, I don't think they'll come up with some type of idea that you've got to stop going after kids while they're young and you can do better, because, to be honest with you, they can't. I mean, if they're going to land the Des Wells, the Devontae Smith Rivera type guys that they've been in on in the past that they got in really early, that's how they're going to do it. I mean, Samaje, either that or they're going to find diamonds in the rough like Samaje, where no one's recruiting him and they find him first late in the game. But yeah, I think you're definitely going to see him continue to do that. And it's not just young guys are taking early commitments. You find this, I mean, you're right. You probably, if you get to know the kid over a longer period of time, you're going to have a better feel for what type of kid he is, so on and so forth. So in that regard, you're right. But I think the bottom line is kids, the recruiting, you're calling them on the phone for a couple hours at night. You're watching them play a few games, but you don't get to know a lot of these kids as people well enough before you have to make some serious decisions. Otherwise, your program's right. going to flounder. And, you know, Xavier made the right decision, in my opinion, by taking a commitment from him. But this is the reality of the situation. It's not a signed and inked contract, and it's not a right given to you after you commit somewhere that they have to follow through on that. It's a two-way street. It's a commitment that both of you had made, and you have to hold up your end of that bargain as a recruit. And in my opinion, Melvin Swift just wasn't doing that. And it wasn't so much that they're like, you can't cut it, you're not coming here. It was, look, for the sake of bettering your life going forward in the future, you probably need to look at options closer to home and figure right. a few things out before you just run off to college. And I think that was more what that was about. But you bring up a good point, but I don't think that's just the reality of recruiting is college kids are sometimes going to not have self-discipline or not going to be doing the right things, and they're going to ruin their opportunities to play at the Division I level. And that's I think Melvin Swift will still find a good place, but it's just not going to be at Xavier because they didn't think it was the best fit.
Billy Gillespie might have offered that eighth grader because the eighth grader was the son of whatever bartender he was trying to finagle a scotch and soda out of at that point. So we may need to discount him.
Well, that's fair, but it's certainly not like he's the only one doing those types of things. So that's going to continue. There's no way around that.
Certainly. So I think we're ready to move on to our second interview of today's humongous podcast, and that will be another legend of Xavier basketball.
It is a big-time podcast when you can get not only the head coach of the Xavier Musketeers on, but also the former voice of the Xavier Musketeers, and now we have to introduce him, Dan, as the insider of Xavier basketball at GoXavier.com, Andy McWilliams. Andy Mack, thanks so much for taking some time out to join us.
Always a pleasure to be with fellow Xavier zealots like yourselves.
Andy, I guess when they make the film of the Xavier Insider, will Russell Crowe be playing you in that one too?
Yeah, pretty an edgy guy, you know, a guy that to be an insider, you've got to be able to be a sleuth, to be hanging around and ready to sop up any inside information. So it's my charge maybe to have a multiplicity of disguises, to be around the Cintas and around the players when they don't expect it, so I can jot down notes and catch some tidbits from Coach Mack and the rest of the coaching staff. I may be disguised as a member of the wait staff at the whoever the caterer is over at the Cintas, or a cleanup crew.
Hey, you could be serving the vanilla pudding from City Barbecue. Or, I mean, the banana pudding, rather.
That's good stuff. I got to stay away from that. You know, it's not good for the figure. But I love City Barbecue. That's one of the reasons that I go to all the home games.
All right. Well,
Andy, last week you did your first Ask the AD show on GoXavier.com, which I assume is going to be a bit of a continuing feature. And there were a couple interesting tidbits that came up. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about your overall impressions of the new AD and talk a little bit about his comments about Big East expansion, which I think have gotten a little bit of air on the message boards over the last few days.
Yeah, for whatever reason, that interview was picked up by the Bleacher Report and there are a few other websites that I guess quoted Greg Christopher. And I really don't think he broke any new ground there other than he addressed all those questions in, you know, one concise soundbite, if you will. He wasn't speaking out of school or anything. And just my impressions of Greg is that he is, in my opinion, probably the perfect, I don't know if he's the perfect hire, a very good hire for Xavier. I think that the Xavier Athletic Department needed a micromanager, a guy who was going to come in and examine all the processes, all the personnel, and with this Big East move, they've got to maximize their situation in a lot of areas and get better and you know, they're very, very good in many, many areas, Xavier, men's basketball specifically. But there are areas to tighten up. And I think Greg, with his experience at Purdue and Miami University prior to that, and then Bowling Green as an AD, has a great skill set. He is taking great pains to talk to all the constituencies, fans, students, athletes, administrators, media, I think he's going to make some moves that he deems necessary, and I think he's going to move the whole Xavier Athletic Department to a higher level in terms of efficiency and execution. But then Mike Babinski did a fantastic job. I mean, he was a great friend to me, and more importantly, a great ally to the advancement of Xavier basketball. If it hadn't been for Babinski and his connections through the NCAA selection committee, I don't know if Xavier would have been at the cutting edge when that shoe dropped. And we all knew it was going to with the Big East. They could not survive football, basketball. There were too many desperate factors there for the Big East at 16 teams or whatever to keep going. But Babinski was right there. He knew what was going to happen, positioned Xavier perfectly, and Xavier is the beneficiary. And Mike wanted to scratch that football itch at Georgia Tech, probably his last job before he retires. And, you know, God bless him. He did a great job for Xavier. But the guys who were in on the hiring, Bob Kohlhaap and Father Graham and John Kusha, And the people who hired Greg Christopher did a great job. I think he's going to be a terrific fit. Well, but I think it's written somewhere in a TV contract that the Big East has to expand to 12. I mean, you know, within a year or two, I don't know what the time frame is. And that's what Greg brought up. And he mentioned the four teams that everybody's talked about. And I would think St. Louis would be number one, and then Richmond would be number two, because they're going to go one west and one east. They're going to have to divide the league up 6 and 6 for all the minor sports to minimize travel expenses and that type of thing. And the other two would be Dayton would be 3 maybe, and VCU would be 4. But right now the Dayton Flyers are definitely on the Big East level. And I don't know if it's an advantage or a disadvantage to have them in the league from a Xavier standpoint. I would think from a recruiting standpoint that Chris Mack would much rather be in the Big East by himself and have Dayton somewhere else. I mean,
yeah, I think
that's
question.
An edge. I think that's a recruiting edge, and I think it's a recruitment edge from a student standpoint to have, kids make decisions based on crazy stuff, and you know, Big East versus Atlantic 10. I mean, you got somebody who's on the fence, Xavier Dayton. I think I might go Xavier's way there. You know,
I agree completely with that. And honestly, that was something that was factoring in. Somehow I ended up at Northern Kentucky University, which makes no sense. But that was something I was actually factoring in when I was considering colleges, was what conferences they were playing in and what level of sports I would be getting to watch while I was on campus. But one of the things you said about Greg Christopher I thought was interesting, because Chris Mack mentioned some of the same things you did about him coming in and just looking at every process that's going on and being very meticulous and being a really hard worker through this transition is something that stuck out to him. And I think going into the Big East, this is probably a great time for Xavier to just kind of self-evaluate, look at everything it was doing and say, like you said, hey, some of these things, some of these processes are great. Some of them maybe could be tweaked or revamped, or maybe we'll just change it. And I think one of the big things that you guys talked about in the Ask the AD segment that's going to be cool for fans is the seating policy, where you get points basically for seniority in season tickets and things of that nature.
Yeah, I think they need a well-defined policy, a fair policy, and you know, with the seating capacity at Cintas at 10,250 or whatever it is, and you know, the Big East I think is going to create more sizzle, and the non-conference schedule is pretty darn good too. Those seats are going to become more of a premium. I mean, they've drawn very well over the years, et cetera, but I think there's going to be real incentive now for people to pile up those points, know what the system is, so they can get themselves in position to move into better locations and get on the list for the Big East tournament at Madison Square Garden, and also be in position to buy postseason, you know, NCAA tickets and that type of thing. So yeah, a well-defined, fair policy is really important, and I think that's what he's moving toward. And he's not going to. I think they had a policy that was maybe already, you know, sort of on the drawing board, and they've sort of ripped that up and they've gone back to. Back to square one, because I think Greg had quite a bit of experience at Purdue and at Bowling Green and those areas, so he's going to bring that to the table.
Andy, as you look at this this upcoming season and you reflect on last season, as somebody that's been around the program for a long period of time, what was your take on last season? We all know about the off-the-court issues that limited the array of players that were available to Chris Mack. But as you know, when it came down that X was not going to get in the NIT, when you looked at that season, what were your takeaways?
On a general basis, I'd say it was like temporary inconvenience for permanent improvement. It's like a road construction project, say on you know, Queen City Avenue on the west side, and
I'm sorry. Where is that, west of 75? I don't go there.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. You guys can't relate to that, but on the east side, I don't know, Columbia Parkway, if you would, for your east siders. You know, the signs go up: temporary inconvenience, permanent improvement. And you know, I think it's not the sign of a deteriorating trend for Xavier. I think Coach Mack took one or more than one for the team last year. He was a good soldier. He gets really well paid, but you know, he could have complained, he could have bitched about some of the decisions and situations, but he sucked it up. He went with what he had, and you know, that's a mature thing to do. And I think he maybe told you that he's really more proud of that group for what they achieved with what they had than maybe some of the other groups that he's had. And I think he's being honest in that situation. I was proud of that group. I mean, he had guys like Landon Amos, won a couple of games. You can make the argument he won a couple of games for Xavier on the road. Purdue, big play. And St. Bonaventure, first league road game, big play to save the day in the final seconds of that game. Very, you know. And Eric Stenger, guys like that came out of nowhere, walk-on status, to contribute big time to that team. I mean, he was making it up as he went along. When D. Davis went down, I mean, he had like basically no guards. Samaje and Brad Redford played a lot of the ball handling spot. Who would ever have thought that he could do that at the D1 level? But okay. He did it, and he did it very effectively, and had some very big games. But yeah, I mean, some guys came out of Travis Taylor just had a fabulous season. And, you know, undersized, maybe, I don't know what he weighed at the end of the year, maybe below 200 pounds in there, you know, grinding it out on the post. So I thought it was an exciting year. They had some great wins when you beat St. Louis and you beat Memphis, and you should have beaten VCU, should have, would have, could have. But, you know, there are a lot of situations that were, the pattern was there where they just ran out of gas at the end of a bunch of ball games that they were in all the way. And, it was just unfortunate. 17-14 with that schedule was pretty good. How they didn't get into the, I mean, I don't know how the NIT makes its selection. It's supposed to be super objective now, but I don't believe that stuff. They should have been in the NIT with the quality of some of the wins they had. But, you know, I think it was time for the season to end, really.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know.
I think that's the case too. I think Xavier was just as happy with the season ending where it was than playing more games. And let the record show also, Andy Mack is a big Landon Amos guy. He was campaigning. He was campaigning to get Landon Amos minutes for this year before we went on air for this podcast.
Yeah, I don't know where he's going to get his minutes because they have 7 returnees and 6 new guys, and I think what they have 12 officially on scout. They can all play, and Amos is classified as a walk on. I mean, look at that. Stanger is now a scholarship player, as he should. He richly deserves a scholarship for what he was on scholarship the second semester last year. He richly deserves to be on scholarship this year for his contributions, in the weight room and the dressing room and on the floor. I mean, look at the 2 Butler games he played.
Yeah,
I mean,
huge
just,
in the Butler game.
Great achievement. And there were other games, and I looked back through the box scores, and there are a couple others that 2 or 3 others where he contributed mightily. He's a talented player. If he could just, you know, find a way to score effectively on the block, just a little bit undersized, or, you know, whatever. But nobody's going to outwork that guy, and I think he can be, you know, he can be, he's the, maybe the technically the last guy on the bench or whatever, but that guy can play. And Tim Stainbrook, Matt's brother, he's an all-city, all-state caliber 6'5 guy who played in a great league at Lakewood St. Ed's. He played against Ignatius and, all those big power Catholic schools up in northeastern Ohio. He's a really good player. He could have gone to any MAC school and been on full scholarship.
Well, Andy, looking at the incoming guys and this year's roster, out of those new guys, you know, Brandon Randolph, Kamal Richards, and even include Jalen Reynolds and Miles Davis into that mix, and Matt Stainbrook too. Or let's not talk about Stainbrook. We know he's going to be solid, but some of those other new guys that we don't know as much about, who are you most excited to watch this year?
And I've seen Randolph play in summer league, and he's ready to go. They have him listed here at 6'1", 190. He's all of that. He's solid, and he played at a big time high school program in Los Angeles, and also he's not like an AAU legend out on the West Coast. Very, very solid physically, and I was talking to Chris about him not long ago. Randolph is not going to back down to Samaje and D. Davis in practice. A lot of freshmen, true freshmen or redshirt freshmen, would defer to those guys because they're experienced and people know who they are, and they'd sort of bob along. And maybe around January the light might go on, but I think Randolph will want to compete with those guys, and certainly Davis and Samaje will know all the drills and be ahead of him in that respect when they get the full practice on September 30th. But I think Brandon Randolph, physically and in terms of his feel for basketball, he's going to be a great third guard. And then Miles Davis is a terrific shooter who can do more than that. So they're going to have, you know, when Davis recovers from his little knee boo-boo there, they'll have four very, very representative guards there. Samaje is, you know, I mean, he's considered one of the top 10 guards in the country now. And D. Davis is more ripped. He's really had a good summer. And watching him in the summer league, it looked like his upper body has just been reshaped there. And, you know, he already would attack anybody defensively or offensively. And now I think he's not going to be asked to play as many minutes as he did last year. And Samaje is not going to be asked to score as much. I mean, he may score more, but I think he'll be more efficient at it. Samaje had a great summer. He went to the LeBron James deal and the Kyrie Irving specialty point guard camp. And, you know, he worked on his three-point shooting, his left hand, all the stuff that were perceived as weaknesses last year. So, you know, I think he'll be ready to go. But the guards are going to be bigger, deeper, more versatile. I think Chris Mack really likes those combo guards. Like, you know, back in the day when Lyons and Holloway played together, they could, you know, one time two would bring the ball up, and the other time Lyons would, and that gives defenses all sorts of fits when you have interchangeable ball handlers there. You don't have one and a half, 2 1-and-a-half guards out there, and that gives them all sorts of problems.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's right.
No, I was going to say, and they've continued to recruit that way. Edmund Sumner, another guy that's kind of caught in between those two positions. He's more of a scorer, but he's got great feel for the game and could definitely play the point guard position at 6'4". So I think they're going to continue to recruit that way, and they're playing that ball screen motion offense, it looks like. And one of the things that you mentioned, that Samaje went to those two camps, those NBA pro camps, one of the things he told me that they really worked on there was ball screen situations and how to create space and how to split traps and things like that and work against the different types of defenses that you'll see in those ball screen situations. And he said he really learned a lot from Chris Paul and Kyrie Irving and Deron Williams in that regard.
Andy, dovetailing off that a little bit, as I look back at last year, I felt like the dominant narrative, and the VCU game was a perfect example, and actually the Temple game was another perfect example, that it always seemed like Coach Mack and the staff were managing the game. They were just trying to get to the next TV timeout. They were just trying to get through that next four-minute war so they could position themselves to have a chance to win at the end. It almost seemed like, I know you're a hockey guy, from your background, it almost seemed like that X was always the team trying to kill a penalty and just trying to get through like the entire game, killing a penalty until the end when they could finally unleash the hounds and try and win the game. This year, it doesn't seem like that should be an issue. I mean, last year we saw the slow pace. We saw the very deliberate offense. I feel like this year, Chris Mack's going to have a lot more options. Do you think that's sort of the narrative that fans should be looking for as this season begins?
Yeah, it better be. I mean, there's no way that there isn't no way, but Xavier's chances of winning a game in the 70s or 80s or 90s last year, slim to none and slim left town. I mean, they didn't have the offensive firepower. They didn't have the versatility or the depth. There is no way they're going to run up and down the floor unless they're playing whoever the Fairleigh Dickinson or something. then they can go out and showboat and cream those guys by 50. But if you're playing a representative D1 team, the only way that Xavier is going to win, you're exactly right, is to keep the score in the 50s or the low to mid 60s. That's the only way they're going to win the ball game. And I think Chris, they played to that style because the bottom line is to accumulate W's. And this year there should be some explosive offensive opportunities. And I think they've got depth all the way through the lineup, and they certainly, you know, it would be great to have a functional seven-footer, but how many teams do? I think another newcomer that's going to be of immediate impact is Jalen Reynolds. He is he's got like a super, super high motor, loves to play, and talk about physically gifted. I think he's like Derrick Brown on steroids. I mean, Brown was, when he got to his junior year, whatever it was, before he went to the NBA, he was a physical specimen. But Reynolds is already there physically. They've got to teach him defensively. He's going to have some problems, get in foul trouble probably, and have to, you know, learn under fire about the pack line and his responsibilities off the ball and all that stuff. But he is really, really a talented player, and he's going to get a chance to play a lot of minutes, I think, unless foul trouble just eats him up.
I just look at Jalen, Andy. I just look at him as being one of those guys, and I've told some people this, where he'll have probably at least two, maybe even three games this year where he has maybe even a double-double, but he goes for 12, 14 points, and he looks all-world. He's dunking on guys. He's grabbing rebounds, blocking shots, just looks incredible. And then he'll probably go through double that or more of disappointing games where he just looks a little lost. He looks late in knowing where he's supposed to be. He blows assignments. He fouls too much, and he kind of just – he struggles along and doesn't get more than 10 minutes in the game or something because he just – foul trouble or mental errors keeps him off the court. But I agree with you. His potential is through the roof, and I think he's going to be one of the most fun to watch this year, even though at times he may frustrate the fans.
Yeah, I can't
exactly
remember.
I'll tell you exactly where he'll struggle. I'm looking at some preseason book. Marquette, at Georgetown, at Creighton, at Villanova, at Alabama. Games like that, where, you know, at Alabama, it'll probably be an SEC officiating crew. He'll be lucky to get out of a warm-up.
Right,
you know,
and his emotions are running high.
Yep.
Andy, I can't remember who you said it about, but one of my favorite lines, and I still use it to this day, you said it on a broadcast back in the 80s, and it was about a Xavier player, and you said he often picked up two fouls getting off the bus.
Yep.
I can't remember who it was, but that's one that I still remember.
Well, there was one, that game that Xavier played out at Gonzaga about 3 or 4 years ago. There is a situation where both Kenny Freeze and who was the other?
Jason Love, wasn't it?
No, Jamel Love McLean. Wasn't there.
It was McLean, that's right.
Jamel
that's
McLean.
Right.
Yeah, Jamel, yeah, both of those, that was ridiculous. I mean, you know, you're not going to win at a place like that because they're going to take your big guys right out of the game. And I love college basketball, great sport, whatever, but that's one of the situations where, you know, they talk about great home court advantages. That's, you know, up there in the Northwest, they have, you know, their little buddies are the officials, and they let the big Canadian kid do anything he wanted. It was ridiculous.
Andy, I think it was the year before that actually the game that I was probably thinking of was when Love and Freeze both got two fouls before the first TV timeout at Dayton. But that's sort of what you expect when you go up there.
Or what happened to Xavier against Illinois at the United Center back in whatever year that was, where the whole front line, I mean, Xavier had built up a huge lead, and you look at the fouls, and it's like Xavier 7, Illinois 1. I'm going, wait a minute now. Let's check out the game. They're trying to catch up to our guys, and we fouled seven times. They fouled once. The whole front line is sitting on the bench. You know, it's ridiculous. And that wears on you. Sooner or later, they're going to catch you, and that's what happened. You have to be in some of those games, like Illinois at the United Center, Dayton at Dayton, Gonzaga out in Spokane. You got to be 15 points better than the other team to win by two. That's just the name.
You don't want to get them
started. Turnabout is fair play. Same thing when a lot of those teams come to Xavier.
You know, Rick, you don't want to get Andy going because I remember the situation where
a seatbelt had to be constructed for him after an incident during an MCC road game. But
I've mellowed. I love officials. They have a tough job, but
I do wonder, Andy, whether
that one guy who looked like he looked like Judge Joe Brown's brother in the VCU game at Xavier last year.
Yes.
Now that was a total joke. That guy,
Mike Babinski, almost killed him.
Oh, he deserved to be murdered or physically restrained or something, because that was borderline sinful what he did.
Andy, I do think though that the fact that so many games are on TV now has at least leveled the playing field a little bit, because I do remember listening to games. Now, obviously, as a child of the 80s, I grew up listening to you call virtually every Xavier Road game because most of them weren't on TV. And the way Xavier used to get homered, or maybe it was just the way you were describing the play, maybe they weren't really getting homered, but the way the games used to be called at Roberts Stadium.
Totally objective.
At Roberts Stadium in Evansville, or at Cobo Hall in Detroit, or
St. Louis was always a joke.
So there were a lot of places where, under cover of no television, the home team may have gotten even a little bit more of a boost.
You may be right there. Officiating has really improved. I'm sure not, but.
Oh, Andy Mack, that's why we get along so well. I agree 110% there. Before we let you go, Andy, what can you tell us? I know you guys are still sort of working on this GoXavier.com position. What can you tell us is kind of your plans and your hopes and expectations for this gig?
Well, it's sort of a work in progress. I'm going to do that Ask the Athletic Director segment. I think it's going to air on the website the first Wednesday of every month. I'm going to get together with Greg Christopher, and we're just going to come up with some questions that have been sent in by fans, or that occur to me, or that occur to Tom Iser, or occur to Greg Christopher. And, we're not going to lob all softballs. I think Greg realizes that people want some good information, and they want honesty, and they, it's not all sweetness and light. So we're going to do that, and there's some other possibilities. I'm going to move my blog or column or whatever, I don't know, whatever it is, over from Musketeer Madness, and I'll probably do a scouting report for every game, and then some sort of post-game article, not a game story, but just my reflections or musings or whatever on whatever happened. I'm not planning to change my point of view on that. It's not all going to be rose-colored glasses. And then I think there's some possibilities, and this is really it's a work in progress to maybe get something going with Coach Mack on a semi-regular basis, or some of the players, get a little more in depth in player interviews after I get to know the guys a little bit better, and they trust me a little bit. Have some fun with it, So I think the sky is not the, I've got a full-time job, and but I anything I do, I'm going to try to do it professionally, and so we'll let it develop. But I'm glad to get the access, and it's good to be working on a more formal basis with Xavier.
Yeah, well, the first Ask the AD segment looked great, and looking forward to more work from you, as I think all Xavier fans have moved around to find you where you've made your different stops along the internet. But it's great to have you back in an official capacity covering the team again. So appreciate you taking the time to do this as well.
Should be fun. And I had a great relationship with the Musketeer Madness people. They're all they gave me that platform for a good number of years, and that's a great place to go for the chat rooms and all that type of stuff. The guys over there, it's a labor of love for those guys, like it is for you, and like it is for a lot of us. We're not breaking the bank or making a whole lot of money out of this, but that's all right. I mean, it's that makes it more passionate. People are interested in Xavier basketball for I think that's one thing I really like about Greg Christopher is that we share, maybe a lot of people say it's silly, it's impossible. We share a vision. And my vision includes a Final Four in the not-that-distant future for Xavier. And if you go to the Final Four, you might, you know, you're going to be there. You might as well win it all. And I think that's a possibility. It's some things have to get better, but I think the resources are there and the people are in place to you know, to upgrade this program and keep the continuum moving on an upward trajectory. And heck, let's win a national championship. And if Marquette can make a Final Four and Butler can make it to two national championship games, I see no reason on God's green earth that Xavier cannot win a national championship.
Andy Mack, you keep giving pep talks like that, and this Xavier fan base is going to nominate you for president.
Yeah, well, really.
I wouldn't want that job.
Andy's too smart. Andy's too smart to accept that.
You see how Barack Obama has aged in the last 5 years?
Oh, God.
Same with George Bush. Thank you. Luckily for Bush, he's back out on the golf course now. He can, you know, recapture his youth.
All right. Well, Andy Mack, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate your time as always.
My pleasure.
So, Rick, great stuff from Andy Mack there. And that sort of brings us to the lightning round, you know, I guess the
your favorite part of the podcast.
Overtime.
Just say it, Dan. Your favorite part of the podcast.
It absolutely is my favorite part of the podcast because we get to BS about sports.
And you're gonna start with soccer. I already know that's where you're going with this.
No, I'm not gonna do that. I will if you'd like me to.
It was a great showing for Columbus. It looked like a cool atmosphere. I did watch some, I will admit.
It was the most amazing atmosphere at a live sporting event I've been to in my life. No questions asked. And this is the third straight. I went in 2005, I went in 2009. This was a completely different experience. And it's becoming sort of, and this is all I'll say, it's become, this U.S.-Mexico qualifier in Columbus has become sort of the event for the sport nationwide. So as you went through the parking lot beforehand, we got up there at 3 o'clock, 5 hours before kickoff, and it was packed already. And there were just people who had flown in from Seattle, Portland, from New York, and it sort of has become this every 4 year Woodstock in Central Ohio, and it really is a special event. I would encourage people that have an interest in the sport to do what they can to get tickets, although it's becoming harder and harder. And it is one of those things. It's become one of those sporting events that I think people ought to make it a point to try and go to at some point, just because the level of passion and the level of intensity is amazing. But
right,
I wanted to talk about the Bengals.
All right, well,
to
because
go from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Well, I do want to ask you real quick, though, before we get off the soccer topic, and I never wanted to talk about soccer on this podcast ever for this long, but it happened, so here we are, and I want to know. Do you think, you mentioned that it's built every year that you've gone to it. Do you think that it is a product of what you mentioned, that the rivalry between U.S. and Mexico has just become bigger and bigger, and this has become kind of this big national thing? Or do you think soccer is really catching on in this country? Because I feel like it's almost one of those things where it's finally gotten to the point where you're now on the outside if you're the guy who makes fun of soccer publicly now. Like, you're the one who looks out of touch with the times if you're the one ripping soccer in public. So do you agree? I mean, do you think that the interest is definitely picking up in our country?
Absolutely. But I think that we're at a stage where the interest is, people are developing interest in the national team.
Exactly.
And or in their preferred European club.
Yeah, the MLS still doesn't get it done.
Right. Well, it is in certain cities, but Americans love the game played at its highest level. And they love it in the NFL. They love it in baseball. I mean, the interest is always going to be drawn to that highest level. But the nice thing about European soccer is they play it in the mornings on the weekend. So it's a nice lead in to college football if you love college football or the NFL. And for a lot of people, adding this to their sort of sports watching program isn't really difficult. And it is very easy to get drawn in by the, it's a little unfamiliar, but I do think that in the last 5 or so years, the way that the game has been presented by ESPN, by Fox, and now by NBC Sports has been in a very respectful way that appeals to a lot of American sports fans. And I do think it's increasing in popularity. I think that the national team has become extremely popular in this country, and you know, maybe 10 years ago the women's national team was just as popular as the men's national team. Now I think both of them have increased in popularity. But yes, I think that I really do, and I think it'll be interesting to see the World Cup in Brazil next year, how the ratings look, because I anticipate it'll beat even the 2010 World Cup, and it's going to continue going in that direction. Do I think it'll ever join the big three American sports? No. But in certain parts of this country, is it already eclipsing hockey? Yeah, I think so.
I think it'll take hockey over for sure.
And I think that's the trend that you're seeing. But, I mean, you know, if you don't like the game, you don't like the game. I've never really seen any point of trying to be an evangelist for the game of soccer. People love it. Some people hate it. And then they have some sort of experience, like they go to a U.S. qualifier, or they go to a big European League game while they're studying abroad or something like that, and they're like, wow, this is really cool. And some people that never happens for, and that's just the way it goes, you know.
All right, well, what do you want to do? I know you're just trying to piss me off probably here. What do you want to talk about with the Bengals?
I want to ask you if you think this loss to Chicago in the shambolic way it happened was a good thing for the team in the long run, because it shakes them out of 4 months of basically every media person in the world, everybody that watched Hard Knocks, just jocking them.
That, and I also, I'm almost glad that they didn't get a bullcrap win in that game. You know, a still win that game by three somehow, because Chicago doesn't take advantage of the ridiculous amounts of opportunities that the Bengals gave them to throw the game away. I agree with you that this was a good thing for the team. It was a thing that they needed to happen. It was incredibly tough to watch. I felt like it was 2001. It was brutal. But I do think it overall it's probably a good thing for this team. And the thing is, there was so much to like about the game from a standpoint of when you were coming in wondering, what's Andy Dalton going to do? How does AJ Green look? How does some of the linebackers look, you know, that are filling in with all these injuries? And how does the safety position look? I was happy with almost all the question marks I had about personnel going into the game, especially Andy Dalton. He looked fantastic, in my opinion, against a very good defense. But yeah, the bungle dome that happened in that game was just incredible.
Yeah, just to clarify, I don't know that it's necessarily a good thing, but it could be a good thing down the road if the team gets its head out of its posterior. The problem for me, though, is it showcased I had two nagging doubts coming into this season, because I really like the team. I really like the roster. I really like the personnel. Number one, is Andy Dalton good enough to win playoff games? Is he good enough to take that next step? I think he is. I feel like he's got the weapons. He did a really nice job in that first game, and I expect him to press on. I don't have a whole lot of concern about him. But my second concern was, is this team, does the coaching staff of this team manage games? Are they strategically savvy enough to win these games that are decided by one possession, or decided by clock management, or decided by how you use your timeouts? Because Marvin Lewis, it's never been a strong suit of his. And what we saw in that game was a complete failure of coaching, in my opinion. First of all, the first strategic issue that completely blew up in their face was the last possession of the first half. When, you know, Pac-Man Jones mishandles a punt, fine. So they're pinned back. They need to run out the clock. Basic multiplication by any fat kid at home playing Madden would tell you that you run the ball three times and you get the ball back to Chicago, maybe 5 seconds left, they have no chance. Yet, inexplicably, they run a pass play on second down, stop the clock, give the Bears all kinds of time, and then Drake Kirkpatrick, who continues his sort of hapless start to his active Bengals career, commits a dumb penalty, and all of a sudden they're in field goal range before it even starts. And that's the kind of thing that you just watch and you just scratch your head. You just say, how this is Marvin Lewis's, what, 10th season as an NFL head coach? How are these mistakes still happening? This is not a new coaching staff. This is not a coaching staff that should be overwhelmed by the moment. How are these clock management snafus occurring at this point?
I have no explanation. I mean, that's the part that's so frustrating. And to be honest with you, I'm one who has felt that Marvin Lewis is probably not a great option as a head coach for a long time now. I don't think he's a terrible head coach by any means. I think he's a pretty good manager of personalities and men on his team. I don't think he's a great motivator, and he's a piss-poor game manager when it comes to things like challenges, clock management, just the snafus, the how are you having the 10 men on the field, 12 men on the field problem back-to-back like that? That's inexplicable. Like that,
which
that
ran them out
happen.
Of timeouts. Which ran them out of timeouts and left the defense on the field bone tired. And I mean, look, there were two mistakes in that game that killed the Bengals. It was AJ Green tipping that ball into the interception the first half, and then obviously Mohamed Sanu taking a helmet, you know, from the blind side.
No,
on the ball
come
down
on,
the 18
dude.
Yard
get the,
line.
Get the ball high and tight, though. What do you have it swinging all out on the side of your body like that for? I mean, anyone, especially the Chicago Bears with Tillman, who's known for that punch move, is going to knock
That's
that
true.
Ball out. It's not like he got drilled. He got a face mask put in the ball, but if the ball is up against your chest, you're fine. That cannot happen.
If he consolidates that catch, the Bengals win the game.
No, without question. Not to mention that, they probably score again. They were on a nice drive.
Right. So it was frustrating. So we've just talked about how we think that the Bengals coaching staff is really good at assembling a team and pretty good at managing the egos, but not so good at the in-game strategy, which kind of sounds familiar, Rick. I mean, if we're talking about other professional
yeah.
sports.
Yeah, oh, I already know where you're going with this. Is there enough time in a podcast for you to vent on Dusty right now?
No, well, here's the thing I want to make clear. I'm not a Dusty basher.
I know you're not. You're not at all.
I think Dusty Baker coming to this team in 2009, he's been ridiculed by everybody. He's been the subject of so much ire, which I understand that he's a lightning rod for criticism. He says some dumb things, but I'm convinced that all the dumb things he says in the media are to take the attention off his players.
I agree.
I think the guy is a phenomenal clubhouse manager, but you know, I really think that the team, they shoot themselves in the foot too often with bad strategic decisions.
He's
and
been bad
while
recently,
I don't think
too.
The problem that Dusty has is because he has this reputation and because of the way things ended in Chicago, his tenure in Chicago, the prior Wood situation, coincided with the rise of sabermetrics, and Dusty became the whipping boy for the statistical analysis movement. So now anything he does, anytime he calls for a bunt, anytime he makes any kind of gut decision, anytime he bats somebody in a place in the order, everyone goes nuts. And I think it's completely overblown and silly. But I still have my doubts about whether or not when you get to the if you get to the playoffs, if you get to a playoff series, if you're in a one game situation, does he have the tactical nu to get you through it? And that's the question. So where do you see that? So we're sitting here tonight. There's 15 games left in the regular season. What do you think is going to happen with the Reds?
Honestly, I don't worry about it all that much. I don't think they'll win the division. I think they'll be one of the two wild cards, and I don't really care all that much which one they are, as long as the Pirates are the other wild card. I'd just rather not it be the Cardinals. But I don't really care if they go to St. Louis and play. That doesn't really bother me that much. Other than the fact that I'd like to go to the game. So for selfish reasons, I hope it's here. But the biggest thing for me with this team is they can beat anyone with their pitching. If it sets up right and they have the right pitching on the right day, they're going to be fine against anyone they play. And at the same time, they're a weak-hitting team. It's not going to be there all the time. And they do have, in those tight games, they have won a couple of guys who have just time and time again made boneheaded plays, namely Joey Votto, and two, I agree with you about the coaching staff. They just do not – Dusty is not great in-game manager in those situations, and I don't think he's as bad as people make him out to be, but I also don't have a whole lot of confidence going into a situation like that with Dusty. So it all just – to me, it's going to be a fun postseason, and I think they could end up doing really well, especially if they get to the point where they're in a real series and not a one-game series. But they have the pitching to compete with anyone, so that's what excites me. I just don't feel like they're going into a gunfight with a knife this year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think they're in a better position to advance in the playoffs this year than they were in 2010, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, look, they obviously do not have a big-time offense. They struggle at the plate, but when you look across the teams that are going to be playing in this deal, in the entire majors, there aren't a whole lot of teams who are great on both sides of the ball. You know, I mean, there aren't a lot of teams who have great pitching and a great offense at all at the same time. So I think the Reds have a legit shot at making a run if they manage to get some hits and get lucky.
But the problem is that they're going to be in a coin flip to even get into a real playoff series,
and that's what worries.
That presents its own problems. I will say this though, I went to the Thursday night game against the Cardinals in the last, which was the one where Frazier had two home runs. That's 7-2, I think. And then I went Saturday, which was the Dodgers game with Frazier's walk-off to score Hamilton. And it was a complete playoff feel both nights. And I gather from people that went on Friday to the Dodgers game and Sunday night to the Dodgers game and to some of those Cardinals games early in the season, that it was the same level of intensity. So sometimes in baseball, you can't focus on the destination, because the journey, when you have those great homestands, you have these big series, it's a lot of fun. And if you're constantly just worried about, well, what's the magic number? Who are they going to play in the wild card game? You lose some of the fun of baseball, because at the end of the day, everybody but one team is going to lose. And it's probably, if the Reds get to the playoffs, the chances are they're going to lose, and it's probably going to be in the most gut-wrenching, heartbreaking fashion, just like last year. But, you know, it doesn't mean the whole season was a fiasco. So I've been enjoying it this year, a little bit less than last year, because they don't seem to have the same magic. But I'm looking forward to seeing how these last two, three weeks of the season uncurl.
Yeah, and I do have to say, it's been incredibly fun to watch Billy Hamilton and Aroldis Chapman recently.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and so the question becomes, can Hamilton hit enough, or can he get on base enough to survive as an everyday player? And I think the jury is well and truly out on that. But as of right now, it's sort of the weapon that he can be. Certainly, you got to put him on a postseason roster, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You have to, because that what he did in back-to-back to games, like, that's the thing. If you get basically your leadoff man on, or even a guy on with one out in a one-run game or a tie game, you feel great about your chances instantly by putting him on the bases. I mean, it just becomes so much pressure for the defense to keep him off the bases at that point, to keep him from scoring at that point, that the pressure is all on them as opposed to your offense getting him around it and scoring him. He's going to steal second. You know it's going to happen. You're trying your best to keep him close. You're throwing the ball around, things of that nature. You're just adding so much pressure to the defense that you have to keep him. Or you expect to be in one-run games or tight games throughout the playoffs. You have to keep them on your roster for that.
All right, Rick, let's do this, and this will be our last act of the podcast. Give me your, as we stand right now, we don't even know who's going to be in the playoffs, because the AL wild card is certainly a complete disaster, and even the Reds and Pirates aren't totally safe at this point. Give me your way premature World Series matchup, and we'll revisit it in a couple months.
I haven't even thought about it, not once.
Well, sure.
I'm going to be honest. I haven't watched any American League baseball. I've watched the Reds barely, and some of the National League. I couldn't tell you in the American League. I have zero opinion on that.
I've got Detroit and the Dodgers, I think.
Yeah, I don't. I wasn't all that impressed with the Dodgers. I mean, obviously the Reds beat them, so that's why I feel that way. But I was expecting more from them. I mean, they've had so much hype from the media with the way they've played that I don't know that they're as good as I originally expected 2 months ago when they first caught fire.
Well, a couple things happened in that series. First of all, Capuano, who's their fifth starter, started on Friday, got hurt. They were in their bullpen early, so that was kind of a weird situation. Neither Greinke or Latos was particularly sharp on Saturday. And then Kershaw threw a couple cookies to Bruce. But in a seven-game series, well, first of all, the idea of potentially seeing three Kershaw-Verlander matchups in a World Series is pretty awesome.
Yes.
I just think that they've got the depth, and especially I don't know what the current situation is with Matt Kemp. There was talk that they were going to shut him down for the season. There was talk he might be able to come back. But that's a lineup that is really scary when you look at even if you get past Puig, you're looking at guys like Hanley Ramirez, who's ripping the cover off the ball, Adrian Gonzalez. I mean, they just have a lot of really professional hitters in the middle of their order, and they would certainly really scare. And any team that can go out and win 50 out of 60 games or whatever ridiculous thing they did over the last 3 months is worth your attention. So
to be honest with you,
Tigers and Dodgers. So we'll see.
To be honest with you, though, in the National League, I feel really good about the Reds or the Cardinals. Whoever comes out alive of the Central, if it's the Pirates, I don't. But if it's the Reds or the Cardinals, I like either one of them against the rest of the National League. They're a bunch of choke artists. The entire National League. I really do like the Reds or the Cardinals' chances.
Well, St. Louis undoubtedly is the best batting order.
Yeah, although the injuries right now are a little. I haven't heard the latest on that.
Yeah. Well, in any event, we'll revisit this the next time, and I'll actually make you make a prediction. You don't get to abstain and completely wuss out.
No, I mean, I just don't have. I mean, you're right. It's probably Detroit in the American League, and like I said, I like whoever in the Central. Basically, Reds or Cardinals, but I don't really have an opinion on the American League because I haven't watched other than looking at standings. I'd say Detroit.
So it could be a rematch of the 1940 or the 1968 World Series, depending on who comes out.
That's exactly
what I was
thinking.
Keep that in mind, folks. All right. Well, that'll put a cap on the Brian Grant edition of the Dane and Victory podcast. I want to thank
or
head
Terrence
coach
Payne.
Chris Mack. What's that?
Or Terrence Payne.
Or Terrence Payne.
Combo podcast.
Combo forward, combo guard, combo podcast. We want to thank head coach Chris Mack for taking some time out of his busy schedule to join us. And then also, of course, the new voice of FBAD on GoZavier.com and former radio voice of the Musketeers, Andy McWilliams, for joining us.
All right. Well, that does it for the 33rd edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, available only on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everybody.